The Movie Morgue podcast is made possible through the support of our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you'd like to learn more about how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/Kwasanim. You'll find a link to that at the end of our show in the show notes. And now, here's this week's episode. Just wash it all, wash it all.
Ladies and gentlemen, insects and arachnids, and non-binary folks of all stripes, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Jess Whitmore.
And I'm your co-host, Annie.
And today, we're going to be cutting into Spider-Man Far From Home, the new 2019 sequel to the MCU Sony crossover blah blah blah.
Words
stuff.
And things.
Stuff!
Stuff!
There's stuff!
Yeah, there's stuff.
Uh-huh. We run a tight ship here.
So tight, so professional.
You didn't call yourself a producer.
I didn't. I forgot about that. You. Oops.
Yes, co-host and producer, Annie.
Two roles in one.
Okay. Anyways, get right into it. Context for this. Me personally absolutely loved Homecoming. Loved Tom Holland in the role. Big fan of Spider-Man, even going so far back as, like, the Raimi movies and the comics. Like, not the deepest dive. Like, I'm not really entrenched into, like, the whole comics culture, but I've read a couple things. Let me tell you, the superior Spider-Man is the greatest Spider-Man comic ever written.
Okay, you're not wrong.
Being said, came into this with high expectations because Sony has been knocking it out of the park, especially after Spider-Verse. Just, like, I'm really happy with whoever they've got suiting for this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it was brilliant.
What about you, Annie? What were you expecting going into this one?
I was expecting to be excited and kind of thrilled by this movie. I think Homecoming is one of the better Marvel films that I've seen in a while. Tight, tight screenwriting, excellent comedic timing, a strong sense of story, well-developed villains, and an excellent cast. I was expecting to see the exact same thing from this movie, and I think Far From Home truly delivered on that. Jake Gyllenhaal was the perfect person to cast. I was super excited to see him in the trailer and so excited to see their take on Mysterio. He's the perfect villain for the current moment. So, yeah, I was very excited to see that they had made this one.
Yeah. Actually, I will make one more comment. I was a little concerned going into this one, actually. I mean, reviews are coming in, and my friends were...
Okay.
I was a little concerned going into this one. Specifically,
was it the poster?
No, it wasn't the poster. The poster is kind of a silly situation. Give a shit. It's a little funny, but I don't give a shit.
Okay.
No, what concerned me was the second trailer. And it was the second trailer that had, like, the spoiler warning about Endgame. And it's like that. And how much of that trailer focused on... Tony's gone and you have to step up and you know, fulfill Iron Man's
the curse
legacy
of
and
Tony
stuff.
Stark.
And I was really concerned about that because, as some of you may know, my personal belief is that Tony Stark is the rotting black heart of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
And I'm just like, no, Spidey, Peter, no, you need to get away from Tony. You need to be less like, and I was like, the one thing that could poison this for me.
Okay, well, I mean, I think that it's relevant to the plot. Let's be honest. It's relevant to the plot of this one. But I think that the direction that they took it in, there's room to push a bit away from Tony Stark. They still kind of, you know, very laudatory of him as a hero, but there's room to push away.
Yeah. But, like, it rolls into it in a way that I really like. So, like, I'm glad that I was wrong about that initial impression, but it was worrisome. Anyways... let's get to the review portion, and I'm just going to start this one because I'm giving this one an A+.
Okay.
This was rock solid, just all around. You got charming teenage romance, you've got incredible action, oh my god, tight dialogue, like, just everything worked for me, just straight up. What about you, Annie? How are you giving this one?
This one gets an A+ from me as well. I think one of the things they've managed to pull off in this newest entry into the Spider-Man franchise is to create a supervillain who actually makes sense. Mysterio is not a dark twin of one of the heroes in the story. He's genuinely a villain for our times, as I said before. A master of media spin. Such great story writing in this one. So much wonderful comedic timing and a fantastic cast. This is one I'm going to go and see again.
Yeah, and I honestly didn't expect them to, like, knock... Like, I did not expect to be as surprised by this one because Homecoming came out of the gate so strong with, like, this really, like, dramatic re-envisioning of the Vulture and this kind of proletariat anti-hero. Not to mention, like, just, like, how well it put together, like, it paid tribute to, like, I think it's Amazing Spider-Man 31 or whatever, the famous one where he's lifting the building. So, like, it pulled so much together, and I was like, they're doing Mysterio? This seems like it's gonna get a little wacky. It seems a little bit more...
Well, but then again, our reality right now is pretty wacky. He's a technological genius who has the ability to manipulate reality through the creation of news stories. Very relevant.
Absolutely. The thing, though, that made me nervous was this whole, like, they really played it up in the marketing, and I really don't like that they played up the whole multiverse angle, because I like it in the film. I like that it's part of this elaborate con, and that it's pretty transparent, but the marketing seems to imply that it may be real, and that we may actually get an MCU multiverse, and God, no, I don't need that. Please stop. Yeah. And it makes me extra nervous.
Yeah.
Just extra nervous when he actually says this is Earth 616.
Yeah.
Well,
they're not ready to do a multiverse, and I think that's fairly apparent. It would just absolutely break the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think it would be a little too much for them to handle. They're definitely dipping their toes into the water here, but...
Here's the other thing, though. They already did that with Endgame.
And it was
bad.
They
did that, and they did it very badly.
It was real bad. Yeah.
So, like, I'm glad they stayed away from that. So let's talk about what the fuck we loved about this.
Absolutely. There's so
much.
Top
of the line, Mysterio.
Yes.
God fucking damn.
Yes. Mysterio. Bad dream daddy. Yes. It works.
Oh, it's always daddies with you, isn't it?
It is always daddies. I feel like that's a common theme. But to be real, though, Jake Gyllenhaal is just the right person for this role. He gave us a lot of Nightcrawler vibes from this character. He gives us what also feels like a mixture of Nightcrawler and, you know, like Tim Cook. I was getting some Steve Wozniak, I was getting some Zuckerberg in there with a kind of like wild-eyed, wide-eyed gaze, as well as some megalomaniacal film director.
Yeah, by the way, I'm putting this out there for the sequels, Mysterio Inc.
I'm down with it. I'm down with it. I think it would be great. You know, ruh-roh.
Yeah, I mean, think about like Mysterio continuing to exist as like a decentralized organization that's just opposed to Spider-Man. Because we've already got part of that is like the whole video that's sent to... By the way, spoilers, I know you guys should know this already. I just feel like I should mention this because I'm about to talk about the mid-credits. But, you know, Mysterio does hurt Peter Parker from beyond the grave.
Yeah.
That is still through the guise and through the apparatus of Mysterio.
Right, right.
So, you know, he's fucking there. He's still fucking there.
He is.
Now, that being said, can we talk about how he fights?
Absolutely.
It's so good. Because here's the thing. I think there's two phases or two modalities of Mysterio that we see here. You see the public spectacle with this big orchestrated, you know, pre-planned production. It's very operatic. It's very theatrical. You know, this is for my wife. This is for my family. You know, just like turning around, throwing up big green lasers and so on. It's really cool. It's theatrical. It's operatic. It works very well. But then you see when he improvs, when he's fighting Spider-Man one-to-one and it's a real fight. And that's a completely different thing because it's all confusing imagery and folding realities and these like merging and unmerging frames that it's just fantastically beautiful. The fight between him and Spider-Man before he gets hit with the train is mind-blowing. Just absolutely mind-blowing. It reminds me very much of the work of something... It reminds me, actually, and Annie,
yeah.
Tell me if I'm wrong here. It reminds me a little bit of Satoshi Kon's work, actually.
Exactly.
It's all these folding frames and ambiguous spaces that fold into each other. Like, I think my favorite shot of that might be when it goes into, like, the spider in Tony's, like, dead helmet, and the spider's eyes become a marching army of Mysterios.
I really liked how Peter could never get a sense of depth of where he was putting his feet, though, too. I like that.
Yeah, or when he's, like, pulls off his head that's a snow globe and drops it as he gets shot. Oh, like, the transitions are so clean and beautiful. Like, that's something that you do not see in live action, and you very seldom see in 3D animated features or, like, stuff. So, like, genuinely, like, in filmmaking terms, this does something incredibly novel. Oh, God. So and here's the thing. I got to watch part of that scene twice, because I've only seen this the one time. I didn't have time to see this because our theater actually had a power outage right after that fight. So they rewound it, you know, and everyone went to the bathroom, we came back, they rewound it for, like, you know, 60 seconds, and so I got to see, like, the second half of that fight again.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's so good. It's so clean.
I mean, the visuals in that sequence are utterly arresting. It's wonderful. It feels surrealist. It feels like it's drawing very heavily on something by Henri Magritte, but also, like, a bit of Dali thrown in there. It's incredibly traumatic, and what I like about it the most is that it simulates the feeling of having your reality ripped apart, which is such a relevant theme for right now. Peter literally cannot find the boundaries. He cannot find the walls or the floors or the ceilings. His world has become strange to him, and I think many people can find something compelling in that visual. Oh. Brilliantly done.
Absolutely. By the way, I also want to say thematically, like, it plays very well into one of the core kind of, I think, like, not metaphor, like, one of the kind of core narrative beats in a Spider-Man, like, kind of, like, the zeitgeist of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Is, if you were better, you could have saved him.
Yep.
Like, that's Uncle Ben, that's Gwen Stacy, that's Doc Ock, or the Doc Connors. In, like, there's so many characters. There's so much of what makes this story happen. And we saw that in Spider-Verse. You know, for me, it was my Uncle Ben. For me, it was my father. For me, there's this idea of the people you could not save. That is, like, an insecurity and a weakness and a vulnerability of the heart that goes, I think, really to every incarnation of Spider-Man. And it's just there. Ugh. So good. So good. You want to just go through performances real fast?
Yeah, why don't we do that? We've got lots to talk about here.
Tom Holland kills it.
Fantastic. He's brilliant.
He's adorable. Oh my God.
He is. He's very sweet.
He's just like... I love that we had the kind of flustered, you know, in love with a girl Peter Parker.
Yeah, as opposed to, like, the original
and
Peter Parker.
It's such a contrast because, like, it does feel so wholesome.
Yeah.
Compared to, like, fucking incel Tobey Maguire Peter Parker.
Yeah, and for those who may not know this, we did a bonus episode on the first Spider-Man film by Sam Raimi, which is worth checking out. It's worth you rewatching this at some point, because looking at this movie now through our present lens, there are a lot of unsavory things in it.
Yeah, so, no, because, like,
just nice to see Tom Holland in this role playing a character not like,
like,
that.
You've got Tom Holland, who's, like, sweet and stuttering, and he's shy, and he's got a plan, but, like, he's afraid, and he also very much, I think, respects kind of her agency in the whole thing, and, like, he backs off when he feels like it's inappropriate and so on. Compared to Tobey Maguire, who just stares at her. Just stares at her. Bleh. I've been in love with you since the sixth grade. Forever. Bleh. Forever. It's so good.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go by the IMDb cast.
Okay, that's
Samuel
fine.
Jackson is Nick Fury.
He's always good as Nick Fury.
Killing it.
Yeah, he's really, really funny.
Actually, sorry. Let me do. Fantastic comedic timing.
Yes, yeah.
Just the scene with the dart gun, very good. Because I think it really plays into the idea that he's Ben Mendelsohn playing Sam Jackson.
Yeah, that's sort of like rambling.
It's that kind of awkward. Well, no, you know, come on. I swear to God, like it's that kind of like frustrated energy that plays so well into comedy.
Yeah, totally.
But also, he has some, like, really badass moments. Like, when he stares down the drone as Maria Hill shoots it out from right in
front
of him.
Oh, that was such a badass scene. That shot is so fantastic, too. That's just a great moment.
And I love Cobie Smulders. She's wonderful. She's great. Jake Gyllenhaal killed it.
Absolutely. He was the right choice.
Marissa Tomei.
I was so excited to see her back in this movie. I am a huge fan of Marissa Tomei. I enjoyed her movies in the 1980s, and I was just... I love her look in this movie. I love the 70s vibe I'm getting from it. The long hair, the bell-bottom jeans, the belts, the big glasses. I love it all, and it was just such a joy to see her back in this movie again. And I love her relationship with Happy. It's not a relationship, it's a situationship. I really like that, too. That's weird. It's great.
I fucking love it! Oh my god!
Yeah.
Like, and, because one thing I like is, in a way, it feels weirdly juvenile.
Yeah, a middle school, high school.
Which kind of works for the script, because, yeah, no, it's very high school.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's in this way, because I think it would be fair to say that we're actually processing everything through Peter's lens. So those are the kind of terms. Because I'm not sure that, like, in objective reality, they're being as awkward and weird about it as they are, so much as they're filtering this through the social interaction with, you know, with Peter. So, like, it's just really adorable. And actually, I do want to give some props to Jon Favreau there because, like, first of all, there's some fantastic, like, ludonarrative conceit here. Particularly, like, I love how supportive he is, how kind of paternalistic he can be, and how he's clearly mourning himself. But I think my favorite scene with him is when he says, you know, Tony was my best friend for 10 years or something like that. And it's just like, yeah, Jon Favreau kind of kicked this shit off. Like, this is his baby. And that's like, it's nice. It's really nice.
It is really nice, and I think that Jon Favreau is actually fairly underrated as an actor. He's in this really fantastic movie. If our listeners have Netflix or some other streaming platform, go and find Chef. It's a great movie with Jon Favreau. He's got a good sense of comedic timing, and I like the way that he does dialogue.
I have not seen that. I want to see that.
It's so worth your time.
I have not seen that. I've seen previews for it, and I want to see it, and I want some goddamn Mexican food, okay?
The food they're making is Cuban. It's medianoches, mm-hmm. but it's really, the movie's amazing.
Well, how do we feel about this MJ? How do we feel about Zendaya?
I like Zendaya as much in this movie as I did when she was in Homecoming. Like, she has done such fantastic character work on MJ. MJ is this amazing girl who puts up these walls around herself by telling people the truth all the time, which they don't want to hear. And yet we see a lot of vulnerability and willingness to try and joke with other people and to try and extend herself. I
do like that, because I did notice that as well, is she feels a little bit disarmed in this film.
A tiny bit.
Because, you know, there is that crush going on where she felt much more in control in the first film. And I like that because there's this evolution of the character.
Yeah.
And, like, she's still whip smart. I love that. Of course, I love that about her.
Yeah.
But I like the, when you look at this teenage romance here, mm-hmm. that they're not really emotionally equipped for it.
No, they're not.
And so, like, they're awkward and they're a little stilted, and it's great. But I also love, like, her interactions with Brad. How she's, like, you know, pushing things. Like, it's very sweet. It's very lovely. Also, can I just say, props, first of all, to her and to the makeup department and so on. Because I've seen her look much more mature and old. And, like, she looks so goddamn young in this. I cannot believe she's... How old is she? Is she, like, 21, 22?
I think she's a tiny bit older than that. I think she's born in 96.
She looks fucking 16.
Yeah, she does. She looks young in this
one. 96.
Yeah.
So she's like 23.
Yeah.
She looks fucking 16. And like you see her in something like, you know,
Greatest Showman. Yeah.
And she looks completely different. I honestly did not recognize her in that film mm-hmm. because I was introduced to her in Spider-Man and just, I couldn't recognize her.
Yeah.
She's lovely. And also, like, two things. Well, one, I love the natural hair.
Yes. They need to keep that up.
Beautiful.
Yep.
Secondly, I love that she doesn't like swinging around.
Right? I also love Bo.
It's so good.
I love Bo. That was cute.
It is. Yeah. Anyone else we really want to talk about going through this?
I mean, there's plenty of secondary characters who are worth talking about.
Everyone else is pretty good. There's like minor roles, walk-on roles. I'm seeing this because like the next one I would really want to talk about is like Flash Thompson, and that's kind of like a...
Oh yeah, Tony Revolori.
Actually, we should talk about Ned. We should talk about Jacob Batalon.
Yes, we should. We should.
Ned?
We should also talk about his relationship with Angourie Rice in this film, which is great. We get to see all the stages of the relationship. And then, all the ones that they go through, and then they come back, and then they break up. That storyline was everything. It's so great. And he has such a great sense of comedic timing. Just
oh god, wonderful. We've all had that friend.
Yes, we have.
We've all had that fucking friend who like gets in a relationship and then drops everything and turns into the shittiest fucking friend.
But also somehow acts like a 30-year-old married man the whole time. Oh yeah. Yeah, no, that was so familiar.
It was great. Like some of the best comedic moments in the whole thing.
Seriously.
From Ned. I love him. I love the job he did.
You know what I also love though? I love the opening movie. Oh my
fucking
movie.
God. The Comic Sans.
The student
the
film.
The fucking Comic Sans.
The Doves.
The fucking Comic Sans.
Like that opening for this movie is worth the price of admission itself. I was laughing so hard that I was actually crying. This is just perfection. It's a tribute video to Tony Stark that includes I Will Always Love You, doves flying, like montages of pictures put together really terribly with Angourie Rice's deadpan.
Oh god, no, like I love the fucking Tony tribute video. Ugh. They included the fucking Getty Images stamp.
Yeah, they did.
It was so good.
Yeah, it was so perfect. I can't even
describe
it.
This is like a video that someone really would have made. It's so good. Like,
it's
you've
so
seen
legit.
Videos like that.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh. Anyone who was ever in a video club in high school saw something like this. It's just so great. I do want to talk about Flash really briefly. I think Tony Revolori is fantastic in this movie. He is a wonderful young actor, and I'm so excited to see him doing more stuff. He's also great in Grand Budapest Hotel and in a little movie called Dope, which I've mentioned before on the podcast. He has such a great sense of story beats and timing. He is the perfect foil to Spider-Man in this movie, I think. And I love his love of Spider-Man, too.
Here's the thing about Flash that I wanted to bring up, because I don't feel like he's given a lot of meat to work with.
He's not. They're clearly up to something. Yeah.
What is being set up, though, I do think they have plans for him.
Yeah, they definitely
I'm calling my shot right now.
Yeah.
Because there's two things. One, his love of Spider-Man and his, you know, derision of Peter Parker are coming directly to a head with that mid-credit sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Directly to a head. So, like, he has to collapse some kind of waveform in the next film. Secondly, when they come home, he's like, Mother couldn't make it?
Yeah.
That says something very important to me. I think he's going to end up being a Venom or an anti-Venom or something.
Oh, that's possible.
Because I think, historically, Flash Thompson has been Venom once or twice.
Yeah.
Depending on continuity and...
context.
Comics are weird, okay?
They are very weird.
But secondly, like, that is one thing that we've really seen very consistently across the villains so far in this, you know, this own little Spider-Verse, is that they're very class-conscious villains.
Yeah.
And this idea of privilege and money not fulfilling the emotional needs of someone, I think is definitely a setup for something significant. Because he has so little that actually contributes to the plot and not the character of the film, that I feel like it's so very clear and obvious that that has to lead to something. Oh, okay, and we cannot talk about casting without saying that J. Jonah Jameson, as J.K. Simmons, is the greatest casting choice of the last 20 years.
Yes. J.K. Simmons is the right one for this role, and I am so excited to see him back. And in this really insanely creepy Alex Jones type take on J. Jonah Jameson, which is definitely pulling really heavily from the Spider-Man game, so I think that's a cool story beat to play with. I think that's an interesting thing that where we're seeing some overlap between the games and the movies. I'm looking forward to see where this goes. This is
oh,
very
InfoWars.
Oh, no,
they
Info
were ripping
Wars.
On that so hard. You look at the typography of that. It's like, it's a green InfoWars. It's got that same kind of slanted angle kind of...
chevron
what's it
thingy?
Called? Not a chevalier, the chevron.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the whole thing. The way he presents it is, you know, we have this exclusive source. The only thing it's lacking is him, like, shuffling papers and pretending they're a source that he can't tell you about. It's the only thing he's missing. Remember, Spider-Man did Benghazi.
Oh, no, not Pizzagate Part 2.
You know that's what he's doing!
Oh, no. No, please, not Pizzagate.
No, this is Petergate.
You mean Peter Tingle?
Oh, that's such a good gag, too. Oh.
It's a great recurring
gag. Okay, so it was very good. Oh, I actually love that. This is such a tight script, too, because, like, I love, like, Peter Tingle by itself is, like, a pretty funny gag.
But they bring it back three times, which is great.
Not only that they bring it back, but that, first of all, like, the spider sense actually does play an integral role, and that they present it in a way unique both from the Raimi-verse spider sense and also from the Spider-Verse spider sense. It's its own thing. It's this kind of, like, heightened action sense.
Oh, yeah,
like, it doesn't
a good
slow
point.
Down time. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
Like, I think in virtually every cinematic presentation of it, it slows down time. But no, this is just, like, it just makes you lightning quick. It's crazy. I love that scene. But also, it's basically all he has. This is something I really love about this script, because one of the things that happens with Spider-Man, it's very difficult, is he is the scrappy everyman hero, and it is the natural kind of inertia of, you know, a just universe, which comics want to portray, stories want to portray. You do not want to present stories about a universe that does not reward goodness or virtue or effort or proactiveness. Like, you don't want to say, like, oh, you know, hero does all this and then they get their house repossessed. Like, you don't want to have stories like that. And so one of the natural things is heroes tend to creep up in power and assets. And, like, you know, you get to modern Spider-Man where, like, Peter Parker is, like, you know, 29 years old and he owns his own science company that's in competition with Oscorp and all that. And it's like, that's not relatable. That's not what we want out of Spider-Man, but it keeps happening. Joe Quesada famously, during the Civil War event, retconned away his marriage to Mary Jane Watson to make him young and single again. It was a really dumb event. He literally made a deal with the devil to revoke his marriage.
So bad.
It's really dumb. It's really fucking dumb. But, like, what I was getting to, though, is, like, Spider-Man is scrappy in this. And I love it. Because they give him the toys. They give him Edith. They give him access to, like, you know, the 3D printer and the supersuit and all that. And then they take them away. And they've actually set this up for the next movie. Because one of the things is, like, my girlfriend was actually asking me, like, how do you feel about him having, like, the 3D printer and the, like, you know, Iron Man-style spider suits and so on. And I'm just like, well, they've kind of taken that away from him for the next movie. And that's great. Because, like, he works so well as a scrappy hero. Because Spider-Man is not an Avengers-level hero. That's just what he is he is a street-level hero. And he keeps getting in over his head. And it's because he's over his head that he's likable and that we want to see him succeed so much. Because when, you know, like, Iron Man goes up against Thanos, I don't give a shit. It's Tony's fucking fault, basically, anyways. But, like, you know, when, like, that's what he does, is he fails that kind of threat. Spider-Man is not suited for someone who's going to wipe out half of Europe. Straight up. He's not. And so when you take away his webs, when you set him in, like, this kind of death corridor, and he fucking perseveres and he wins anyways?
Yeah.
That's fucking great!
Yep. Yeah, it is. It's fantastic.
But also, like, the human cost, he's still young. And that's something that's really great. Like, honestly, it breaks my heart when Mysterio dies.
Yeah.
Because you know that Peter would have tried to save him.
He feels guilty. Yeah. Yep.
It's just like, it's so good. He's like, when he asked Edith, like, you know, is this real? That, like,
oh, yeah.
You know that he wants her to say that it's fake, that he got away. You know that's what he's asking her to say.
Yep.
It breaks my heart. Oh, it's so good. I just want to watch it again. It's really so fucking good.
It is really good, and I think one of the things that makes it so strong is not just that we want to watch it again in theaters. I feel like I would watch this if it came on TV, and it would hold my attention. which is one of the things that I've kind of noticed with a lot of the more recent blockbusters that have come out. That's not the case with them. You know, we've talked about Ready Player One a lot. We've talked about The Predator a lot. Those movies are not fun to watch on the rewatch. This one would be, and it's because there are really strong performances and the writing for this movie is very, very tight.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look at this movie specifically because not only is it well written, because you can have a, like, there's no objective, you know, best script, but like you can have a script that follows all the best practices and follows all the beats of, you know, the screenplay by what's that famous screenwriting book? I forget. Or, you know, like writing scripts for fun and profit, you know, stuff like that. You can follow all the beats. You can follow all the conventional wisdom and write what is, I guess, on as close to a technical level as can exist, a perfect script. And it can still be boring, predictable, and like, yeah, I guess it's tight, but like, it's nothing new. This movie is original.
Yes.
This movie, exactly. Especially in contrast to the MCU. Because the thing, you could have another goddamn villain that's a twisted mirror and a father figure to the goddamn hero. But yep. Like, this, like, twists that on its head so much. Like, you know, it's Peter desperately seeking a father figure that kind of leads to further trouble.
Right.
It's this con man. He's not this existential powerful threat. He's actually a weak-ass piece of shit who gets by on guile. We don't see that in these movies. You look at, the Vulture. Compare him to the Vulture. Like, the Vulture is like, and both of these are very class conscious here. You know, the Vulture is kind of getting shit on by industrial contracts and so on.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the small business owner. These guys are like, you know, angry tech bros who are shit. Like, and I like that because, like, yes, he's shit on by the system, but also I think you get the sense in that scene where he's like, yeah, but if I were in Tony's position, I would be the one shitting on everyone else.
Yup. Because that's who he is.
So, yeah. Like, you have this kind of class consciousness to these villains, but even so, there's this complete difference because, like, the Vulture is just, like, an actual, like, terror. He's a terrifying force. He's, like, this golem that descends out of the sky and plucks you and, like, drops you. Like, he almost kills Spider-Man, right? And he throws him in the fucking river. So, like, compare that to this guy who's, like, all pomp and, you know, panache, but is actually, like, he does not have power until Spider-Man gives it to him.
Well, I think he did have power before. So, like, he has enough power that he can convince a group of people to do this, right? And that's something. And he had power when he was in Stark Industries. That's also something. I think the thing that's going on here is that Spider-Man is sort of like a catalyst. He can sort of draw more media attention to what they want to do, and he can amplify in these ways that they may not have had access to before. So he's necessary to this equation.
Well, that's the thing, though, is I think maybe it's not fair to say that Spider-Man gives him everything he needs, but what Spider-Man gives him is a force magnifier that takes him to the next fucking level.
Yeah. Yep.
Because I think, you know, Mysterio, because, like, my thought of for what the story was going to be, kind of midway through the movie, was that Mysterio was going to go to Berlin and, like, assassinate a bunch of, like, people and, like, set himself up as a hero in more of a kind of, like, attack on the UN kind of thing. And I think that might actually have been his plan before he got Edith, although it seems like the plan was to get Edith. So I guess it was a plan. But, like, the key component to things unfolding as they did with a degree of magnitude and a level of danger and sophistication that he did was to get Edith from Peter. It was abusing the trust of Peter. It was gaining that trust of Peter. That is what gave him the power to be the threat that he was. Because, like, I think, like, if he was in opposition to Mysterio at the very beginning of the film, I think it would be a pretty short movie.
It definitely would be. I mean, that's the whole point of this movie, is the heel turn, right? It's like a good wrestling match where you have a face character that is a protagonist who all of a sudden turns heel in the middle of a match and starts beating up on their opponent when they're down. That's that moment, that turn from face to heel, is what makes this story work. It's what makes it so compelling. It's what raises the stakes. I like that about this movie. I think it's a good way to tell Mysterio's story.
Yeah, it's very good. Can we talk about Edith for a minute?
We should. Yeah.
Because This is one thing that I really like, and this kind of turns on what I was afraid of from the trailers, is that this is all Tony Stark's fault.
Once again.
This is just cleaning up Tony Stark's fucking mess. Because here's the thing. I don't know how familiar y'all are with Batman, but Batman, the Batman, Bruce Wayne, the big fucking kahuna of the Justice League, of the DC Universe.
Yeah.
He made an evil supervillain plan to take out the Justice League that got stolen. Mm-hmm. One time.
Yep.
And they fired his ass. Tony keeps fucking doing it. And even in death, he is still the fucking problem.
He is. I mean, you know, weapons system, a gift for a child. Tony.
Like, okay. Like, what's he done? He did the fucking helicarrier thing.
Yep.
He made an army of robot jackboots that told people to get into their fucking homes.
Check.
He made Ultron. He made Check. Vision, which had some problems.
Yeah.
He fucking made. Oh yeah, no. And before the Ultron thing, he also had an army of Iron Man armors that were all automated.
Oh yeah, like, that's right.
He's a goddamn super. And now he has a satellite full of invisible drones that can just kill people. Whatever. He has protocols. He has goddamn protocols programmed into Ida that says, "Hey, do you want to kill this guy with no kind of judicial review or oversight?" It's like, you're a superhero. You are the Randian Ubermensch. I have chosen you as my successor. You have power over life and death, Peter. This is my gift to you, because I have chosen you, and you are now greater than any other person.
But he privatized world peace. Yay.
It's incredibly fucked up.
It's very messed up.
It's incredibly fucked up.
Very.
Like, and like, the cinematographic... The cinematic... the cinematic language of how the Ida system is presented is fucking terrifying.
Well, yeah.
Because it's like that satellite that shoots out the thing. This is like something out of, like, you know, James Bond. It reminds me of, like, this is a scene that lives very much in my memory. Is like the first introductory scene of You Only Live Twice, the James Bond movie, where, like, the satellite killer, it opens up and eats. Like, this kind of, like... It's like, or like GoldenEye, the satellite. It's like this thing floating in space, and then it just launches something, and it's completely silent because it's in space. It's this kind of like monolithic, titanic, like obelisk of death. And that's what Tony put in space. Like, there's no ambiguity to the visual language of that. It is a weapon. Tony left a goddamn super weapon.
In the hands... of a teenage boy who is mad at someone.
And also the implication, here's the other implication, is that he's been wearing the controls to that
the
entire
whole time.
Always.
Like, yeah.
Honestly, I'm actually kind of surprised that they did not break the glasses in this film.
I think it was telegraphed early on in the screenplay that they're somehow unbreakable, and I'm not sure why I remember,
that.
So if you see it again... let me know if I was right or if I just misheard something.
I mean,
something.
I'll watch it again. I'll keep an eye out for
that.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. And just going back to the glasses, though. I do love the kind of visual language of that. Because it's these, like, expensive, douchey, transition sunglasses.
Yeah, that sure don't work for Peter. But once Mysterio puts them on, the crown fits super well.
Because it makes him look like Tony, the douche.
Yep.
It's so good. Like, so here's a question. Do we have any, like, deep theses or, like, metaphorical themes that we're kind of looking at for this one?
I'm not sure that I have anything deep to say about it, but I mean, I think the character of Mysterio is going to be read as a sort of analog for Donald Trump. Although I think that the character of Mysterio himself is an amalgamation of a bunch of different people, particularly corporate figures like Mark Zuckerberg, Tim Cook, Steve Wozniak, which I've mentioned before. Like, he is a representation of a kind of corporate tech bro who feels like they can make the world over in their image to gain celebrity and fame, which I think is relevant not only in the world of business, but the world of politics, certainly in the arts as well. There's definitely a commentary going on here about directors and their egos. There's lots to look into.
I think one thing that you could look at as this kind of like modern reactionary kind of analog to him, and I'm not necessarily saying that he is a reactionary, but like when you pull on that thread, is this idea of supremacy over principle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's like a core tenet of, you know, right-wing politics these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I could get into that, but that changes what this podcast is
about.
That's
a different podcast.
I have a lot of words to say about this. But... because one of the things that you see, and I think the bar scene, first of all, is fantastic.
Yeah, it's well done.
I love the reveal of it. Even if it is like a, aha, I've won, this is my supervillain speech, let me reveal my plan. But one thing that I like is, it's a couple of things. One, it's a dramatic reveal for the audience. Two, it's like this kind of heel turn. But three, it is the king maintaining his levers of power.
Yeah.
Because he is not yet in this position where he can survive without these people. When you look at the management style, compare him to the Vulture. The Vulture accidentally kills one of his dudes because his dudes are underlings. He is the Vulture. He is the core and the heart. He is the boss. He runs this town. Right? There's the guy who does all the experimentation and the building. That guy is probably indispensable. Everyone else, you can get rid of. Like, you know, you're the new Shocker. Right? But in this case... he needs these people. He cannot function without them. So he's paying them lip service and he's making sure that they are appreciated enough to get him where he needs to go. And then you see...
yeah, it's very Gavin Belson from Silicon Valley in many ways, I think. Similar power structure, similar dynamics.
There's a little bit of Jack in him.
Yeah,
there's
that too.
There's a little bit of Jack. Because here's the thing, though. When things go badly for him, he turns on them.
Yeah.
He literally threatens them with guns.
Yep.
And that's kind of revealing, is that he is not so... He's in control of reality, but he's not so in control of an actual reality or of his minions and of his co-workers, so to speak. He doesn't have fuck you money yet. Right? He can't replace all these people yet. But there are signs and there are hints that when he does, their asses are going to be disposable. He is a tyrant that is not yet in complete tyranny. I'm trying to get at something. I don't think I'm phrasing it correct.
No, I think you are phrasing it right. Mysterio, in many ways, is somebody who fits into the middle of the power structure. He's not like Tony Stark, who's a CEO who's at the top. He's in the middle, so he answers to someone above him, or at least he did before the movie started. And he also answers to the people under him who are working with him as part of a quote-unquote team, right? It's very much this critique of the neoliberal power dynamic that you see in tech spaces as well as in the arts. These people who have a compelling vision that they need a quote-unquote team to help them realize, all the while treating the members of that team as though they are disposable or fungible, right? So I think that's what it's playing on. Either this kind of like megalomaniacal director figure or this kind of a similar figure in the tech industry. I think both are legit.
So something I think that's interesting here, and I think this is a core kind of aspect of the Spider-Man mythos, and I'm going to go on a weird tangent here for a second. Because there's a tabletop role-playing game that I really like called Mask, The New Generation. It's a teen superhero game, and instead of like classes like you'd have in D&D, you have different playbooks. And each playbook has a different source of drama. You have the Doomed, which is, you know, a hero whose power will eventually kill them. You know, you have the Protege, which is like, you know, you're Robin or something, where, you know, you have a mentor figure who's a, you know, you have the Legacy, where you're like, you know, Shazam or something, where there's heroes before you whose expectations. But there's one particular one called the Janus, the Two-Faced, you know, and it's about balancing this life of being a hero and being a civilian. And that's kind of one of the core conceits of Spider-Man, is that, you know, Superman can dispose of Clark Kent. Batman has, at times, disposed of Bruce Wayne. Spider-Man is still Peter Parker, and being Peter Parker is important to him. And that's one of the things is that we've seen, I think, that's kind of different in this one compared... I think there have been comics that have done this. I can't say that with certainty. But in the cinematic universes, we've never really seen a Peter that has accepted his life as Spider-Man and tried to really integrate the two worlds. You know, there's always been that conflict. So when he talks to MJ, he admits it and he draws on his friends and he's kind of accepted and integrated those. One thing that I really like is that the universe is not rejecting him for it. Because they are compatible, they do work. However, tragic circumstance at the end of the film, through conspiracy, through malintent, and through enemy action, that harmony and that equilibrium and that homeostasis is destroyed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that makes the story a bit new in some ways.
Because, like, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, when you look at, like, when you look at the, for example, the Raimi-verse, being Spider-Man destroys his relationship with Mary Jane. In more ways than one. It's part of what, you know, hurt his relationship with Uncle Ben. It's part of what hurts his relationship with Aunt May. And when you look, compare this, and actually I think another interesting example is you look at Spider-Verse, for example, where Peter Parker's that universe's Aunt May knew who Peter was and was actually part of it. Like this idea that there is a path where other people are part of who you are and what you are. And I think it's very much the opposite to kind of this Iron Man story they're saying, that there's this singular person that the world needs to rely on. That, you know, you have to be Iron Man, you have to be Tony Stark, you have to be this Randian Ubermensch. Right? That you have to be an island and you have to be able to be Atlas and, you know, bear the weight of the world. Whereas Peter, he needs his friends. He needs his family. He needs Happy. He needed Tony. Like, he's not an island. He's a fucking kid. And so this idea that you actually have this reaching out and you have this collapsing of the waveform that does not reject him and say, you fucked up. You have put everyone in danger. The world is going to end. Your life will never be the same. Everything will be ruined because you dared. Because you dared to try to synthesize the two parts of your life together. I'm very pleased to see a film where that's kind of a thesis to it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good storytelling.
And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the mid-credit for a sequence for a second.
Okay.
Because this is kind of interesting to me. Because I think this is the only post-credit scene that I give a shit about in the last, like, 5 years.
100%. Yeah.
Because I think there's a couple different formulas for how these go. There's, like, you know, you start with, you know, the 2008 Jon Favreau is like, have you heard of the Avengers Initiative? You know, you have the Captain America, you know, come out, it's like, I had a date. That one's really good. That one's fantastic. Where it's just this kind of extra note, right? But this is, I think, the first one for a while that is actually part of this film. It's not an advertisement for the next film, although it makes me excited for the next film. This is the ending that was too bitter to be before the triumph. Like, this is the anticlimax. This is the kind of downturn. This is victory turning to ash in your mouth. And so they let us ride on the hope. They let us get to the credits. And we're excited, and we keep that, and we believe that, because that's what we're cinematically trained to do. That's what, you know, the story is over. We're at the credits. The story is over. The heroes have won. We're good. But no, and that's why it actually punches you in the gut. Because first of all, you're there, you're cheering, you're like, and I think there's like this like great like kind of narrative conceit to it, because as an audience, you're sitting here, you're going, holy fucking shit, J. Jonah Jameson is back. All is right in the world. It's something even more exciting, right? And then they drop the hammer. And then they drop the hammer that your life will never be the same. That the status has changed. And it feels like part of this film. It's just that they've separated it from the rest of the film. It's an epilogue, not an ending.
Yep. Yep, and I think that's why it feels so authentic to the story.
And, like, that's really significant for me. And I like the kind of arrangement of it, because, like, the post credit with the Skrulls, I don't give a shit. Like, that's the MCU. I don't give a shit. Like, it's good that I've seen it and that I know what's happening, but, like, if I watch this again, which I will, I can just walk out after the mid-credit and I'll be happy.
Okay. Okay.
Did you have any thoughts on kind of, like, the positioning of that, like, where they, because, like, I did hear a lot of discourse about this, and I was trying very hard to avoid it, because people were saying, like, oh, you're taking, like, you know, plot crucial information and putting it in the post credits now, and, like, people are discussing this, and I think it's really weird, because, like, significant things have happened in post credits before, but never like this, never something that's actually felt so much like a part of the film.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what's going on here is that Marvel is signaling to their audiences that they are moving into a new phase of storytelling. They are using this post-credit sequence to kind of, you know, diverge from the formula just a tiny bit, just enough to let people know that the way they tell these stories is going to change a little bit. That post-credit sequence is really, really solid. It's a great cliffhanger. It's a wonderful hook that pulls the audience into thinking about what's going to happen in the next film. Like, it's a really exciting moment. And I really liked it. Like, this is the first time that I've seen one of these and actually been like, oh boy, I am very excited for whatever comes next. The second one, you know, I know you said you were just kind of like, shrug, whatever. I thought it was really cute. I was happy to see the Skrulls come back. I actually like them as characters in some ways. And, you know, Ben Mendelsohn is always a lot of fun to see on screen. It was kind of an odd one in terms of ending scenes, yeah. But it was cute.
Mendelsohn was great. I'm sorry. I love the comedic timing in that. It's just like, you know, the thing, and, you know, like, you know, just like you said, like it feels like such a real conversation. Like, you know, you've talked to people like that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like, you've been that person.
I have been that person like, several times,
awkward, and I love it.
Yeah, the Ramblers,
the Gambler, the Backbiter.
What? Yep. yeah.
But no, and like, that's the thing, and I'm not saying like, I'm not sure that people are necessarily coming in with that, with this kind of critical eye. It's just like, I think it surprises people, because this
is
a novel way of using it.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. And like I said, I think that's a very deliberate choice on the part of the studio. I think that there is an attempt here to signal to audiences, they're changing up the way they're doing things. And we're going to see more of that as Marvel moves into opening up their new streaming platform, too.
Hell yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Oh, God, no, it's such a kick in the gut, though.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's a good one.
Like, because he had everything.
Uh-huh.
He did, and, like, this is something, like, I you know what I think it kind of is? Actually,
what?
And I think this... And I'm doing this off the cuff. This isn't a prepared thing.
Okay.
I haven't thought this out a lot. But tell me how this reads to you. This is the first time Spider-Man hasn't blue-balled us with the ending.
Yeah.
Because what Spider-Man always does is Spider-Man always pulls out right before the happy ending is, oh no, I can't be because I betrayed my best friend,
right,
or because I'll put Mary Jane in danger or this. Like, it's this kind of why it's like Spider-Man does not allow himself to be happy. Not in cinematic terms. And
no, not in cinematic terms. I mean, they're always movies filled with sexual angst, which is annoying.
Exactly. So instead, I'm not going to call it indulgent, but I'm going to call it, like, authentic and celebratory. Like, he gets the girl. He's working on it. And it's not, like, this perfect idealistic, like, wouldn't it be nice? Like,
right.
It's not that. But,
yeah,
you know, he's trying at it. He's moving forwards with his life. And things are going well. This is Spider-Man resolving and moving forwards with his life in a way that I don't think we've really seen. And then they pull back. And then, like, they let it go one step further before they drop us. They let us trust them for one more second than any other Spider-Man film ever has. And that's why I think it hits so fucking hard. Because we trust the forms of cinema. This is something that we've actually seen, like, and you can actually see it on, like, almost like a physiological level. Have you ever been to, like, an electronics store and they've got all the TVs on and they've got, like, that interpolation mode on that, like, turns everything to 60 frames a second?
Oh, it's the worst. It's awful.
And it looks awful. It looks like a sitcom.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that we feel that way is because we have been watching film for 100 years and for... most of that 100 years, we've been watching film at 24 frames per second.
Yeah.
So we're used to motion blur. We're used to a certain way things move. Like, you know, we had to adjust a little bit, actually, to how slow motion works. Like, you remember, like, 80 slow motion when they would actually slow the footage down?
Yeah, I remember.
And, like, now we have modern where you're, like, changing the frame rates dynamically on the camera and all that. And you actually, there's a lot more preparation set up for that. So, like, we're used to this. So, I think this is, we're actually looking at something that I think is more novel. Because, like, the post-credit has always been, like, a little, like, crispy bonus. It's like, oh, you know, you get a little ice cream after you. It's a dessert, right? And it's always what it's been. But what this is they've taken the form of cinema where they've taken the credits are here, you can relax, like the rest of it's going to be hype, the rest of it's going to be like little funny scenes, it's going to be all this. And they've taken that, and they've taken that expectation that we have spent the last 10 years developing, and they use that to punch us in the gut.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the purpose.
And I think that's why it's so impactful. And I think that's why, I don't think people necessarily feel betrayed, I just think people don't know how to process that.
No, they don't, and that's important.
I want to see more movies do this.
I also want to see more movies do this. I think it's a really engaging way to reach out to audiences. But it's going to be really interesting. Like I said, you know, Marvel is opening up this new streaming platform, and that's going to change the way that a lot of these movies look and sound. So we'll see. I'm hoping that Spider-Man remains a theatrical release. Some of the other characters will have TV shows, but this one is meant to be seen on a big screen, I think.
Yeah, and I'm going to agree with you on this one. I want to see more fucking Spider-Man. Like, the Spider-Man cinematic universe is far more interesting to me right now than the Marvel cinematic universe is.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we continue to see Sony making movies at the same level that they've made stuff in for Spider-Verse and for this movie, it's going to be a great couple of years. I think they're doing some really compelling storytelling in this series. I think a lot of people really like Spider-Man and kind of relate to this story a lot. And I think they've also done some really cool things to change Spider-Man as a character with the times. That's a really cool thing to see. So I guess I'm just excited where this goes next.
Yeah. Anyways, I think that wraps this up. Actually, letter to John Watts.
Yeah,
I'm just going to say, dude, good fucking job. Just more of this, please. Thank you. I love you.
Keep doing what you're doing. We love seeing this stuff. And this movie was an absolute blast to watch.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Anyways, this has been the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. You guys can follow us on Twitter at Movie Morgue Cast, on Facebook at Movie Morgue Podcast. If you want to support the show, please remember to, you know, like, share, retweet, comment at us, like, tell us what we missed or what we fucked up on, or like, tell us what we did right. Spread it around. Word of mouth is probably the best thing. You know, leave us reviews on Facebook and iTunes, whatever it is. Now, that being said, for me and my work, you guys can find me on twitch.tv and on twitter.com at Quasinym, that's Quasinym. Annie, where can people find you and your producer?
Yes. Producer. Still getting used to that. Well, people can come and find me on the Discord. I'm usually around there lurking, reacting to people's posts randomly. So come and find me there. Let's chat about movies. We're always talking about something, whether that's movies or TV or video games. So come find me in the Discord.
Yeah. And our intro music, as always, is Trouble by Ipso Factibus. You can find a link to their EP in the show notes. And if you want to take things a step further, beyond just telling your friends, which is, by the way, the most helpful thing you can do, we do have a Patreon at patreon.com/Quasinym, where for as little as a dollar a month, you can get our bonus episode on Spider-Man along with others, and you can help us keep the lights on and, you know, keep me out of ramen.
Yeah, that is true. That's true.
You know, I'm honestly surprised we haven't gotten like a Peter Parker has to eat ramen.
I am too.
Yet.
That like, feels so.
That because that's the thing. That feels like a very Spider-Man thing, doesn't it?
Yeah,
like
the
struggling
it does.
College student thing.
Yeah.
I feel like it's. Yeah. Anyways, thank you so much. We love you. We thank you for continuing to support us and making this possible. And we'll see you next time. All right. Have a great time. Bye-bye.
Bye.